History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Late in 1944, 13 US B-24 bomber crews bailed from their cabins over the Yugoslavian wilderness. Bloodied and disoriented after a strike against the Third Reich, the pilots took refuge with the partisan underground. But the Americans were far from safety. Holed up in a village barely able to feed its citizens, encircled by Nazis and left abandoned after a team of British secret agents failed to secure their escape, the airmen were left with little choice. They either had to flee or be killed. Today's guest is Charles Stanley Jr., author of the new book, The Lost Airmen, and he describes how his father, Charles Stanley Sr., was able to escape. Charles Sr. was a pilot of a B-24, and he and 17 other airmen had to basically escape into a blizzard and go over 100 miles over mountains with no food or resources in order to reach Allied safety. Drawing on over 20 years of research, dozens of interviews, and previously unpublished letters, diaries, and memoirs, Stanley recounts a deadly journey across the blizzard-swept Dinaric Alps during the worst winter of the 20th century, and the men who fought impossible odds to keep their brothers in arms alive. This is an important story of survival, but it shows how the dangers of World War II weren't confined to combat. They could also be found in the battle against nature. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Charles Stanley. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You wrote a book about your father's service in World War II in 1944, specifically, and the journey that he and the B-24 crew went on to escape from Nazi-controlled Yugoslavia. So let's start out with the beginning of his story, and we'll weave in some of the wider issues here and describe what's happening in that particular part of the war. So walk me through from when he enlisted to serve in the military until when he was serving in Europe with the Army Air Corps.
Sure. Well, I guess it starts with a draft breathing down his neck. And, you know, he, like all young men of the time, had a choice. He could wait and be drafted, or he could volunteer for one of the specialized services. And he didn't want to join the Navy. He couldn't swim, didn't like water. And he decided to join the Air Corps because that was the sort of the glory service of the time. So he signed up, he passed the qualifying examinations, and he entered training. He entered what was called the College Training Detachment, a program that was set up to basically give prospective officers the background they would need for later phases of training. And really why they added that element of the process was that they had so many pilots trying to get through the system is they couldn't deal with them all at once. So they decided it would be wise to send them off to this kind of academic training for a while. And while he was in that training is where we meet him in the book and where he meets my mother, his future wife.
Then when does he begin to serve in Europe? Is it in 1944? Is it after D-Day? Is it part of the amphibious assault in Italy? When does he begin going on missions there?
Yeah, he took a ship to Italy via England. He did it in August of 1944, which is after D-Day, after the fall of Italy. And he joins the 15th Air Force, which has already set up camp in southern Italy. You know, the 15th is a lesser known wing of the Air Force than the 8th, which was flying out of Britain. And not as many people know about that as they should. But they're in Italy for a couple of reasons. One is they thought they'd get better flying weather out of Italy than they did in England, which in the end didn't happen. But also because there were targets that had been stashed out of the reach of the 8th Air Force that you could get to from with the bombing range from Italy at the time.
Let's zoom out. Could you describe the state of the war in late 1944? And what sort of bombing missions was the 15th on? What sort of objectives did these missions have in Yugoslavia?
Well, whenever I interviewed these guys, they used to correct me. I'd say they got shot down over Yugoslavia. They'd correct me and say, no, I bailed out over Yugoslavia. I got shot up over Germany. So, yeah, they basically what they were doing is flying over Yugoslavia, trying to get to other targets. Occasionally, there were targets in Yugoslavia, but not very often. So they would bomb targets in southern Germany, like Munich or rail yards in Budapest. But most of their targets were oil targets in Silesia, which is in modern-day Poland. And at the time, most of what they were doing was, it was all about oil. By then, the Romanian oil fields at Ploiesti had fallen into Russian hands. And Germany, as we know today from the Ukrainian crisis, has practically no native oil. So with the Romania gone, they worked to convert coal to synthetic petroleum. And basically what the 15th Air Force was doing was bombing those synthetic oil targets. And my father was shot down over the same target twice, a place called Blackhammer.
And then also looking at what he did on the B-24. Now, from what I've read on World War II aviation, B-17s and B-29s get much more attention. B-17s for being the workhorse in Europe, B-29s for their experimental nature and the particular needs that they met in the Pacific. But could you describe in general a B-24 and what he did on that crew? Typically has, you know, a typical bomber crew, pilot, navigator, bombardier, gunners, etc. So what did he do on the B-24?
Well, my father was a pilot, but I you're right that the B-24 is far less known than the B-17. And again, I think that's part of the sort of the bias in the media coverage at the time, because the 8th Air Force flying out of England was mostly comprised of B-17s. And so when people think about the bombing war and say 12 o'clock high in the movies and the television series, you always see B-17s. But the B-24 was actually used, or there were more B-24s used than B-17s in the war, though most people don't know that. And there were arguments about which was the better aircraft at the time, and each had their good points. So that debate continues among aficionados to this day.
And for all those aviation nerds out there, I suppose we can, you know, give them a little bit. What are the arguments for, let's say, the B-24 for its superiority against the B-17?
Well, it was faster. It had a greater range. It had, partially it was because of the unique nature of the wings that it had. It had what was called a Davis wing, which was a narrow, highly aerodynamic wing. So it was, again, and it also had different engines than the B-17 had. So basically, the B-17 could fly higher because of its broad wing, and it could sustain a lot more punishment in the wings anyway. If a B-24 was hitting the wing would collapse, and that would be the end of it.
Getting to the central action in your book, how is his plane shot down, and what happens when they land?
So, yeah. So, as I said, he was shot down twice. The first time was on October 13th, 1944. And he goes to Blackhammer with his bomb group and gets shot up, loses two engines on the same side. And he has a decision to make. He needs to, you know, he could try to get back to his base, but he knew that with two engines, he couldn't make it all the way back to Italy. And one thing about the one disadvantage of the B-24 is that it you didn't want to ditch it. You didn't want to try to land it in water because it would basically fall apart. And he didn't want to do that. As I said, he couldn't swim. So a lot of the guys would try to make it to Yugoslavia and bail out over Yugoslavia. At the time, though, they didn't have a good sense of which parts of the country the partisans held. So actually, he decided to do something that I've never heard of anybody else doing. He took a shot at getting to Romania, which was quite a bit more distant, but not as distant as Italy. And he barely made it over the Russian lines and bailed out with low altitude that was not exactly textbook. So he was lucky to live through that, but he gambled and he made it.
So what happens when he and the crew bail out? Where do they land? Who controls the territory that they're in? And what are the first things that they do when they're trying to assess their situation?
In the Romania excursion, they actually did quite well. They got beyond the Russian lines. They were picked up by local Romanians who turned out to be friendly. And that was a little bit of a surprise because, you know, Romania had been a part of the Axis and had contributed a lot of personnel to the war against the Russians. But it turned out that the Romanians were friendly towards Americans anyway. And they helped my father and his crew get to Bucharest, where there was a mission established to repatriate the flyers who had been shot down when the 15th was bombing Ploiesti.
And then the other event, the other bailout, what happened there?
Yeah, so it was my father goes back into combat. He flies a number of missions and goes back to Lechhammer on December 2nd, gets shot up again. This time it's the two engines again, but on the other side of the airplane. But this time he'd been briefed on, and his navigator had been given a map of the areas held by the partisans. So he felt much more comfortable about heading towards Yugoslavia. And he gets to central Bosnia, and his navigator says, basically, it's time to jump. We're over the right area. And my father says, can't we get a little closer to the coast? And the navigator says, no, we know this is a good area, and we don't want to go through bailing out from a low altitude again. Now's the time. So my father reluctantly agrees, and he has the crew bail out.
The village that they land in, there's hope that they'll have contact with, I think, British agents that can secure their release. So what's the village like that they arrive in? What are their expectations when they arrive there about eventual escape and what actually happens?
Yeah, let's talk about Sanski Most. Sanski Most is a decent-sized town on the Santa River, and it had changed hands a couple times during the war, but it hadn't seen the destruction that some of its surrounding towns had. And its main advantage, though, was that it's a rare flat spot in the middle of Bosnia. And there was a landing strip outside of town that had been used for other evacuations in the past. The problem was that when winter came, the landing strip was in a floodplain and it got wet and you couldn't land planes on anymore. So three crews had already gathered there in similar circumstances as my father's, but they were basically stuck in that town because the Germans were retreating. So the path to the coast was cut off and the planes couldn't land. So they were just sort of sat there and waited for winter to freeze the airstrip outside of town. So they basically just get stuck.
And I understand that they had hope that British agents would secure their release. What happened here?
Yeah, I don't know if they knew at the time when they bailed out that the British agents would be there. But basically what happens is the airmen talk to the commandant of the garrison and the partisan garrison in Sanski Most. And he knows where the British agents are and he sends a message to them. And there's actually agents to the north and to the south. And two agents show up with a radio man and they try to arrange an evacuation for the pilots. But between the soggy airfield and bad weather in both Yugoslavia and back at in Italy, the various rescue attempts fail for weeks on end. So the Americans are stuck there in this little town.
They're stuck there. As far as they know, they're surrounded.
Yeah, they're surrounded.
So what is the eventual plan that they come up with to escape the town? Where do they plan to go to? And how do they eventually leave?
Well, the partisans get, they're friendly and they do all they can for the Americans, but they eventually 84 airmen end up in this town and they start to kind of overwhelm the resources in the town. You know, this is wartime and resources were scarce and the town basically can't support them anymore. Plus, the Americans each have $48 of gold-backed dollars in their escape kit, which is a small fortune in Yugoslavia and at the time. And so the Americans are well-meaning, but they, in the beginning at least, they don't understand or appreciate the value of their dollars. And they start paying American prices for, say, eggs or chickens or whatever they could find. And that's probably a good 10 times what they were getting in Yugoslavia. And so they cause inflation and the farmers and everybody in the market saving all their goods for the Americans. And the people are starting to get fed up with it. So they love the Americans, but it's just starts to create a bad situation that's really nobody's fault.
What did it look like specifically with the B-24 crew that your father was on? Are they operating as a unit? Are they working with these other crews to plan an escape? And how do they eventually escape?
Well, it's interesting. They sort of, nobody's really in charge of the Americans. You know, it isn't like there was a anybody senior to anybody else unless they sit down and discuss their date of rank. They're all lieutenants, the pilots in charge of their own crews. And there are parts of 13 crews eventually gather. So there's really, if there's anybody who's at least coordinating for the Americans, it's a B-17 pilot named Robert Bardish, who was the first guy there. And just because he was the first guy there, he's sort of the liaison with the partisans. But eventually the partisans get so desperate to get the Americans out of town that they try to send them to the coast overland, despite the danger from the Germans who are still controlling the countryside. And to make a long story short, the attempt fails and the Americans get only a quarter of the way to the coast and need to turn around in a blinding blizzard. And end up returning to Sanski Most. And the partisans, again, are just, they're ready to expel them again, no matter what it takes. But fortunately, the British agents established contact with Italy, and headquarters is able to send three planes to Sanski Most and try to pick them up.
What happens here when the planes arrive?
Yeah, so the planes finally do arrive after four failed attempts. Actually, four times the planes got over Sanski Most and weren't able to land because of the low ceiling. But finally, on January 5th, they were able to land at dusk, and the pilot in charge of the transports, these are C-47 Dakota transports, and they do manage to land, but the major who's in charge of these planes declares that the planes can only take 66 of the 84 airmen out. The pilots in town protest that they knew that those planes could carry a lot more if they needed to. And sure enough, when these planes were taking off, one by one, they each took off rather easily. But I think what the guy in charge was thinking of was that his plane's capacity was 22 paratroopers, but paratroopers carry a good 80 pounds of extra weight with them while they're bailing out over enemy territory, and you know those 80 pounds times 22 add up. They could easily have taken up to the number of men that there were in town, but he didn't. So my father, although he was one of the earlier crews in town, volunteers to stay behind, probably because he wasn't anxious to get back and get shot down a third time. And so this major promises he'll return the next day for the rest of them. And of course, he never does return. So, never volunteer, as they say. It's not a good idea.
Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors. But first, I want to give a shout out to all the great shows on the Parthenon Podcast Network, including Key Battles of American History. You can find this show and many other great ones like it by going to ParthenonPodcast.com. For these airmen left behind, what happens next? How are they assessing their situation, and what do they decide to do?
You know, even though there's only 18 people left and these guys had promised to return, and the airmen they said, OK, well, let's just wait a couple days, basically. But the partisans weren't having any of it. And they decide they're going to send them out overland again. And so begins a really desperate journey in January of 1945. Remember, this is the same winter as the Battle of the Bulge and, the worst winter of the century in Europe. And they have to cross the Dinaric Alps, which are pretty rugged mountains. I equate them to the Adirondacks. If anybody in your audience has ever flown over the Adirondacks, they're pretty rugged and pretty there aren't a lot of roads in and out. And that's I've flown over Bosnia, and that's pretty much what it looks like. So they begin the journey. There's a little train that can take them about 20 miles out of town. They have about 120 miles as the crow flies to get to the Adriatic. But after a time, they reach a rail junction where there's some cabins, and they get snowed in. A blizzard comes, and they're on the side of this mountain and in three cabins with their partisan escorts, and they get snowed in. The snow gets so high that they basically have to go outside and clear the windows. They're afraid they're going to suffocate from all the snow that's falling. So eventually there's over 6 feet of snow that they're getting buried in. And along with their partisan escorts, there were two extra partisans, one who was clearly an officer in a uniform, and his aide. And these two guys decide that they need to press on. They have dispatches that apparently need to be delivered. And they go out in this blizzard, and eventually the aide comes back and he says, we just couldn't make it through. And the officer had frozen to death. And the aide has a frostbitten leg. So eventually the party runs out of food, and the head of the partisans decides they have to press on to the next station regardless, because they're out of food and things are only going to get worse. And he also decides they can't carry this frostbitten partisan because his leg is bad. And it's 8 feet of snow, and they're basically swimming through the snow to get anywhere for, you know, dozens of miles. And they just can't carry him. So one of the dramatic moments of the book is when they have to leave this poor fellow behind without much chance of survival. But eventually our Americans and the rest of the partisans make it through to the next station and travel on through various stops and get to the coast and the port of Split, where there's an Allied station and relative civilization.
You read several memoirs, interviews, unpublished letters. You conducted your own interviews. And are there any particular accounts that stand out to you at this time as they're going through the mountains? They are running out of food or out of food, and how do they describe this?
Well, it is interesting that the process of interviewing these guys was psychologically interesting as to what they remembered. You know, I'm interviewing them 50 years after the fact, and different things stuck out to different airmen. But what struck me psychologically is that all of them, their memories are all perfect about what happens in the airplane when they're in the process of bailing out in that crisis mode. The adrenaline must have embedded the memory in their mind, because they all remember very clearly the order that they stood in as they were getting ready to bail out. Every little detail, they all agree all the time. There's never any disagreement on what happens in the airplane. Occasionally, when they're on the ground, they disagree, or they have different memories and different things stick out. But it's that moment in the airplane that's universally remembered. I thought that was just fascinating.
Well, what would you describe to their survival as they're going on this overland journey? How does your father make it? How do other airmen make it?
Yeah, my father actually had one of the reasons that my father's highlighted in here. I don't consider this to be a book about my father's journey necessarily, although it begins with him and ends with him. I kind of use him because I knew the most about him, and not just because he's my father, but because he left behind so many good records. He had corresponded with my mother through the war. They had a good 600 letters apiece that survived the whole time, and his memory was just plain excellent. He remembered everything very well. He was never wrong about anything he remembered. And I checked him. I checked hundreds of details, and his memory was just great. But he did not remember leaving that partisan behind in the cabin. That was a recollection that I got from several of the other guys who he traveled with. And I was lucky to be able to interview about half those guys that took that journey with him and got those details from them.
What do you think enabled them to survive as they go on the overland journey? Did the weather clear? Was it just camaraderie, or what do you ascribe it to?
Oh, in terms of that, for one thing, they were fit, you know, and they weren't just sort of average. Of course, they were all in their early 20s, but these men were tested to be the best of the best. They were carefully selected. You know, they were the top 2% of Army recruits. And they went through not just rigorous mental training and flight training, but also physical training. So they were in good shape, and that helped. The other thing that they all noted was how rugged the native Yugoslavians and the partisans were. That, you know, some of these 18 airmen that walked out were former football players, some pretty big guys. But when it came to breaking the path through the snow, it was the partisans who did most of the work, because they were so inured to the conditions that they were just the way the airmen described them. They considered them to be basically superhuman as to their endurance and ruggedness and along this journey. So it was really a combination of the airmen's fitness and the partisans' ruggedness that they got them through.
How long did it take them to reach the coast, approximately?
It was about 3 weeks. So not all of it was in 6 feet of snow, but a good part of it was, you know, pretty tough conditions. You know, one image that sticks in my head was that the snow was so high that and they'd be walking along these roads and these valleys, and there would be telephone or telegraph wires sitting there, but they would be waist high. So whereas normally they'd be a good 10 or 12 feet off the ground. So they'd use the telegraph lines as like guide wires, the guide wires that they would pull themselves along the journey. And it gives you a sense of how deep that snow was.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. What condition are they in when they finally arrive on the coast? Are they starving? How are they doing?
They're starving. In fact, there's a cute story about how there's sea rations, you know, the basic army rations waiting for them in Split. And everyone declares that it's the best meal they ever had, you know, whereas one of them might, and the labels have fallen off the cans, so nobody really knows what kind of food they're going to get. So one guy might get, I think there were four different kind of dishes that they might get. One was corned beef, another was stew, but they all declared that it was the best meal they ever ate. And, you know, good old army chow. And yeah, they each of them lost a tremendous amount of weight. My father lost 30 pounds. And most of them were hospitalized when they finally got back to Italy and had a long period of recovery. And some of them went back into the air and had to fly again.
Can you describe the overland journey? Do they ever encounter hostilities? Do they encounter other people who are partisans, who are friendly to them? What were notable parts of this overland journey?
Well, they had... some of the crews did run into Germans once they bailed out, but along this journey, they did not luckily run across any Germans. And I say luckily because these guys were lightly armed and they only had a half dozen partisan escorts. You know, the airmen carried 45s, but they're not trained for that kind of combat. If they'd have run up against a real German patrol, they would have been in trouble. But in the villages that they passed through, they did run into hostile folk. And, you know, there's a civil war going on in Yugoslavia at the time. The partisans are fighting the Chetniks and the Ustashi are fighting both. And, you know, it's we can get into those factions if you like, but it's a very dangerous territory. And, you know, some of these factions are pro-German and they run into locals who are pro-German in virtually every stop. And the partisans are basically commandeering houses and forcing people who are not necessarily pro-American to take in these airmen. And I remember one story about how Lieutenant Michaels, who's the partisan in charge, points to his eye when he's leaving some of the airmen at a woman's house and basically telling them, "Keep an eye, sleep with one eye open because she'll slit your throats if she gets half a chance." That was his message.
I'm curious, you touched on earlier what happened to them after they were rescued. Many had to be hospitalized because of their condition. Some returned to active service. Overall, what do you, when you were speaking to these airmen or reading their accounts, what about this experience really stayed with them? And what did they make of this escape and their eventual rescue?
Yeah, they let's answer the first part of your question first. So in terms of them going back into combat, the rule was that you had to be missing for 42 days to be eligible to be sent home. And it turned out my father, being one of the earliest to arrive in town, he was missing for 42 days and was eligible to be sent home. And he was sent home. One of the guys who walked with him was only missing for 40 days. His name was John Mulvaney, and was sent back into combat and was killed on a later mission. He had been gone for 40 days. If he'd have been missing another 2 days, he would have been sent home and would have survived the war. But Mulvaney was killed on February 22nd and during another mission. But in terms of what stuck in their heads, actually, I think as I said, I think it was really the bailout that was their most vivid memory. And of course, their various stops. I think the mind tends to want to forget pain and forget the arduousness of the journey. And you know, we all tend to do that. And what they remembered was the stops along the way, the woman who would have slit their throats if she had half a chance, the resilience of the partisans and the mutual respect that the partisans had for the Americans and vice versa. And that's, I think, what they came away with, particularly the ruggedness of those people. That really struck them. They were impressed by the partisans and the civilians and how strong and tough they were.
What do you hope that readers of your book get from this story?
They, you know, these, well, we want their sacrifices to be remembered. And that, I mean, that's partially what history is about, is I don't know that there's a great lesson here, you know, that to take away, but there's a, you know, we've all heard about the Greatest Generation, and these were truly remarkable men, and their story deserved to be told, and they deserve to be remembered. And, you know, fortunately, a few of them are still alive, and they're enjoying their 15 minutes of fame now.
Well, there's a lot more to this story. And for listeners who want to explore it more, the name of your book is Lost Airmen, The Epic Rescue of World War II U.S. Bomber Crews Stranded Behind Enemy Lines. Chuck, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.